You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Excellent. Well, welcome all, and particularly welcome to Larissa. I have, in a sense, followed Larissa, who is a.k.a. DJ Ripley, for some years, and particularly because she combines an interest in two of my passions, one of which is copyright and the other is Jamaica. She adds into that music, which seems to be the mixer, and somehow she has become a student of creativity in the context of Jamaica music and copyright. And I've just been fascinated with her interest and her instinct that there is a relationship that may not be positive between copyright and creativity in Jamaica. And so I'm just extremely delighted that she's come to visit and talk to us. I would, though, like to introduce Wayne Marshall, ethnomusicologist, Mellon Fellow at MIT, fellow lover of Jamaica, of music and copyright, and former teacher of Larissa. No? It was through, I thought it was through Brandeis.
No.
Well, Wayne, I ask you to introduce Larissa.
Thank you. I would say I'm a longtime friend of Larissa, and I think of her as an esteemed colleague, so it's a pleasure to welcome her here today. Her work is of great interest to me because I'm also very concerned or interested in the intersections between creativity and copyright, and I find, along with Larissa, Jamaica to offer a very interesting case with regard to that, as I'm sure she'll tell us a lot more about. To extend Charlie's introduction, let me just note that Larissa is a PhD candidate in the Jurisprudence and Social Policy PhD program, program department at the UC Berkeley Law School. So she could be called a legal anthropologist. She brings to bear a lot of methodologies and approaches from social science onto her study, including what is now a sort of long-term, multi-sided ethnographic project in Kingston and in the important diasporic sites of New York, London, and Toronto, to really think about how Jamaican musical practices travel and are transformed depending on their local context and so forth. In addition to doing that academic work, as Charlie hinted, she's really involved in the sort of level of praxis herself as a sort of genre blurring DJ who is often informed by Jamaican aesthetics and plays a lot of Jamaican music, and also working at the level as a sort of public intellectual, writing a very interesting and engaged blog, and also doing a variety of journalistic projects, including posting at the Public Knowledge Project out of D.C. So without further ado, let me turn it over to our dear friend and colleague, Larissa Mann. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me here. It's really exciting to come and be a part of the kind of conversations that are happening here. I won't add a lot more to the great introductions that already came from Wayne and Charlie, except to say that part of my interest in my approach in thinking about copyright comes from a pretty sustained study early on in property rights and land and studies of commonses, not in the abstract sense, but in the very grounded sense of communities that manage resources together in specific locations. And that sort of has informed the way I've looked at intellectual property, both in my critique of privatized understandings of culture, but also my critique of some of the discussions of openness that come around that I think are ungrounded from community practices and material constraints. So I'll try to give a sense of that. I did spend a little less than a year in Jamaica doing my fieldwork, learning about how people involved in music making acted and talked about ownership, access, originality, ethics, quality, and a lot of other issues that are sort of evoked by copyright law and copyright law debates. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, focusing just on two specific examples that come out of my research. And I'm going to focus on Jamaica for today, although my dissertation also deals with the diaspora, but I figure to keep it under 15 minutes. I should keep it narrow. So just one other word about jurisprudence and social policy, the department that I'm in. One of the ways that people talk about what we do is that we study the gap between law and the books and law and action. And I think this is a nice beginning. But once I got to Jamaica, I felt that what I was ended up studying instead was basically the relationship between social institutions and social practices and legal institutions and legal practices, which is to say not that there's this missing step or this failure of communication between the law and what people do, but that people are doing things and that the law is another institution and that they interact in certain ways. And I hope that will come out from what I'm talking about. So I thought I should start with the dance before anything else, just so that we know where we're at. We all could do that. So this is just a scene from a street dance from a couple years ago. Outside the frame of the video is a DJ playing CD turntables with a mixer. He's got a microphone. It is a he. It's mostly he for DJs, but not always. There are other people around him. There's also giant towers of speakers. There's people selling food and drink. There's lots of women and men talking, singing, posing, dancing. It's a very interactive and dynamic space. And I start with looking at the audience because I think the audience is, what we would call the audience, is really integral to music making and to how music works in Jamaica. They're not passive receivers, as you can see. That's not a very passive looking crew. They're active parts of the music scene and they contribute to how music develops. After that point, the other point I would make is that even though this is intensely local, it happens on the streets of the city, in spaces literally on the streets, on the sidewalks, and in parking lots. It's also happening in a global system. People who make music for the street dance, but they make music for the street dance knowing that the street dance is part already of a global system of communication and symbolism and interaction. So location really matters, but it matters both in relation to the people who are there and the material realities there, but also to the larger world. And this isn't a new development. This has always been true. One of the ways that this is made manifest is in the technology that people use in the street dance. So this is, you can see there's a video camera, there's speakers, there's mixers, there's CD players, there's headphones. Of course, none of these were made on the island, so that's one network invoked. But also, all of these things engage with recordings, and the recordings circulate. Many of them upload, so people are also using cameras and cell phone cameras, as well as the video camera, and are uploading these things to the internet, and those recordings also circulate. And so what you're starting to see more and more, that is a difference. This circulation is different in that it's much faster and much more prevalent. And you're starting to see ubiquitous, increasingly globally networked technology in the dance hall and everywhere else in daily life. And this, of course, isn't specific to Jamaica. And this matters for Jamaica, I think, and for Jamaicans, not because the global relationships and that are encouraged by this network are new, but because, in fact, they're not that new. The networks of communication that exist are informed by the networks that have already been there. So, of course, the earliest global network is the network that created Jamaica as a nation, which is the slave trade. And everything from communications, from how cables are laid, from how satellites work, from the languages people speak, to the allocation of resources that are available to people is informed by this history. And it's not to say that that history determines what's going on, but all of these lines of communication are not random and they're not spontaneous. They are informed by this past. And so I have to say that it's embedded in global colonial capitalism because that's basically what it is. And when I say colonial, I don't mean that there are colonial powers now acting as colonizers, but that power is a colonial force. It's informed by this history. And that informs not only nations like Jamaica, but places in the U.S. That's, I think, one way to understand how racial politics work everywhere, is understanding this history of colonial domination that leaves its traces and its trails and its institutions everywhere. So this map of the global north and the global south is only the crudest beginning of describing how colonial power works, because of course even within those countries you have elites that are closer to colonial power than, to some extent, than people below that, and on and on and on. All power, I think, is informed by these kind of relationships, and these are not only along racial lines, of course they're along all kinds of lines. This is obviously about class. Gender plays a role. All kinds of different ways of coming in on this, I think, are informed by this colonial relationship. So I'll come back to that. But one way to think about this in relation to copyright law is to realize that anytime you talk about property rights in the colonial context, I think it's worth being extremely careful and extremely critical, because in fact property rights and competing definitions of property rights were one of the main justifications for colonial intervention in the first place, which is to say people showing up from European centers and saying, these people just aren't acting right with respect to property, they don't have any rules, they don't know what they're doing, we're going to be systematic, we're going to tell them what's going on, and that's why we have the right to do what we did on this land or in this place or with these people. So whenever I hear language about property rights, it says, oh, there's this whole group of people and they're unruly and they're not acting right, I start to get a little antsy, and especially when the people saying it are in fact representing groups of people who had a colonial relationship to the people they're talking about, which is something that happens in Jamaica, where you have international agencies like the World Trade Organization hand-wringing over poor behavior on behalf of Jamaican musicians. I start to get a little suspicious about what other networks of power are going on underneath it. So copyright law is also an interesting nexus between technology and culture, as I showed before, that technology is permeating how people engage with culture. Because copyright law is a set of rules for how people are allowed to engage with cultural artifacts like writings and recordings. And technology is increasingly one of the ways that people do this engagement. Copyright law becomes a sort of intermediary force in shaping that engagement. So for me, the question that I ended up with as I was gathering my data is, does globally network technology and or copyright law reinforce the coloniality of power? And for me, this is more interesting a question than are these new technologies good or bad for this community or that community? Because good or bad depends on what you think the problems are to begin with. And for me, I think I'm taking it as read that the coloniality of power is a bad thing, that it's against equality and human dignity and autonomy. This is not to say that colonized nations didn't have inequality in them, but it's to say that indisputably coloniality is an unequal hierarchical situation. So is copyright law colonial in Jamaica? Well, literally it was, in that it was on the books, the British law, even after independence copyright law stayed the same. So there's an external reason to think it might be, at least up until 1993, because the British law was not in existence for the benefit of local Jamaicans. There's no reason to think that this law would be for the benefit of local Jamaicans. It's also a formal legal system, and to some extent the contours of formal law are often dictated by the colonizers' terms. So language, literacy, education, stability of access to material resources, like having a fixed address, a place to store paper, all these kind of things that allow you to engage with the law, to be seen as a professional or a respectable person, those are also symbols of your ability to access a sort of colonial privilege. They're historically and institutionally situated to be more available to those close to colonial power. So those are the external reasons. And then, more importantly for my work, I think internally copyright law has some characteristics as written that also reflect this kind of inequality. Because it assumes, copyright law assumes specific things about music making that are based in specific creative traditions. Traditions originating in roughly the blue places on the map that I showed you before. So assuming a particular set of cultural practices and then enforcing that framework on people who may have very different practices, I think, is going to be problematic if you were concerned about coloniality, and also if you were just concerned about the effectiveness of a legal regime. You're not going to get the outcomes that you might think, necessarily. So what are these culturally specific assumptions? Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume that many people in this room have thought critically about copyright law before, so I won't go too slowly over them. But the idea that there are discrete, identifiable individual authors, that originality is a coherent category that we understand and can define, and that works are something fixed and discrete and identifiable as well. These are assumptions, I think, that most copyright law, and certainly the copyright law in Jamaica that comes via the TRIPS agreement and the World Trade Organization, have as a sort of baseline for how it functions. And these are all really problematic assumptions when you look at Jamaican music. So now I'll get to the fun part. I just wanted to give my framework, but now I'll get to the fun part with a couple examples. And the first example that I want to talk about before I get to the street dance is that of rhythms. And this is something that Wayne himself has dealt with very well with Peter Manuel in a great article called The Rhythm Method. How many people have heard the word rhythm before in relation to music? Just a few. Okay, great. So a rhythm is the instrumental part of a song, roughly speaking. If you have vocals and you have the instruments playing at the same time, if you separate out the vocals from the instrumental, this is what has become a rhythm. And a rhythm circulates independently from vocals in Jamaican music. So I'm going to play one, and then I'll give you an example of it. So this is a classic rhythm. So this is a famous rhythm called Stalag 17. It was first recorded in 1974 by a band led by Ansel Collins. And it's a lovely tune. Rhythms go back, at least in recorded form, into the 50s and 60s, and probably before. Of course, the process of recirculating instrumental versions and singing on top of them is something I think people have always done. But it was made material in vinyl records, so a pre-digital era. In Jamaica. And what you got very quickly was many different vocalists singing on the same rhythm. So this is from 1982. Here's one from 1992.
Sound boy, your this is also a burial. Watch the sound. Wanna hear me? Wanna hear me quick?
All right. So, in fact, there are 279 songs cataloged on the Stalag rhythm, more or less, on this website. There may well be many more. There are a couple different websites that categorize rhythms. They're fascinating things to go through. So, a rhythm is both more or less than a song. It's an element of a sort of participatory musical experience. Vocalists sing over them. And a lot of recording studios in Jamaica basically just have a little booth like this one, and then a hard drive or a stack of CDs, or it used to be vinyl or masters, and they would just bring in different vocalists and play the rhythm and have people sing on top of it. And so somebody was making the instrumentals somewhere, but many more studios are just a voicing booth like this. Rhythms are also really useful for dancers because they are repeated. What happens often is a DJ will play multiple rhythms, the same rhythm with multiple vocalists over the rhythm, one after the other. And there's an art to doing this so that it's exciting. But dancers know what's coming because you know the rhythm, so you hear it over and over again. And so even though there's variation in the vocals, which is exciting, you also, as a dancer, can be right on point with what's happening. So it's a sort of useful tool for getting the audience to be interactive. And then DJs, as they're lining up rhythms, are also getting on the microphone. They might introduce the new vocalist or in other ways interact. And so rhythms become part of, through this repetition, shared cultural knowledge that everybody has that invites people to participate. And they also take on a life of their own. People know rhythms by their names, independent of the songs that are on top of them. And they also show up as recordings within other songs, as samples. And I just want to give one other great example of interactivity in which rhythms show up inside another song. So this is an American hip-hop tune, which was remixed by a Jamaican artist.
This is where we at. 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 Why? Why? The girls say love me, so we know, say we at. Hatting up the chat. This is where we at. Step up in the club of champagne, we are pop. Serious, we serious, and a chat, we are chat.
Okay, so you see what happened there, right? So what I just did is give you guys a bit of a shared cultural reference. And I think because of time, I'm not going to replay them all. But you heard it. I heard people recognize it, right? And that's exactly what a DJ would want to be doing. And that's something that would make an audience happy. So that's a really important aspect of being interactive with music. I saw people smile. You know, you recognize it. You feel good. You know something. You're in on the joke. You're in on the story. You know, so that's a really important part of how you build shared culture, build musical community. So what's also interesting about this, of course, is that it was a Jamaican interacting with an American song. And I think this is important because it shows that it's not just people drawing on past traditions, it's a living tradition in which people engage with the culture that is around them, and they need to be able to do that. And of course, we know there are legal concerns around being able to incorporate existing culture into your culture, so I'll just flag that for now and come back to it. But basically, right, these are some of the contradictions with the assumptions in copyright. Shared culture versus private ownership, repetition versus originality, references versus fixed works, and circulation versus permission. So the problem with technology in this case is that it can bring copyright law considerations into all these practices because all of the technology that people are using can potentially embed law in it. And we've seen that this is something that particular interests or particular agents have been really interested in. So from ASCAP trying to charge licensing fees for ringtones on your phone, Sony's willingness to embed tracking software on your home computer that would report back to some other authority about what you're doing with copyrighted material. Even before that, DAT machines having a built-in limitation of only being able to make one perfect digital copy. These are all ways in which the law has been embedded into technology. And in this case, it really works against a creative tradition, which we might think of as valuable. So I'm running way over time, but I want to talk about the street dance. So I'm going to keep going for a second. So the street dance is the center of the music scene. If we focus closely on it, I think we can see how technology can both reveal some possibilities and probabilities for people to achieve greater cultural flourishing and overcome some of the colonial inequalities, but also some of these risks of having this colonial sort of eye embedded in all of the technology. Dancers are sort of, the place to start with this. Dancers have become one of the hottest sort of hotly discussed people and actors in the creative scene in Jamaica. Dance was always important, and dancing was always important. But in recent years, dancers have reached international fame as dancers. And this, I think, has to come from the integration of video and easily shared video into the street dance. And there are always tons and tons of video lights and video cameras at street dances at a lot of all over Jamaica, everywhere I went, both official ones and also people taking their own videos, as I did with my little camera, and then people post them online. This is Bossy Tuesday, which is a party that I went to a lot when I was in Jamaica as part of my research. As you can see, that was the worst part of it, definitely. And as you can see along the side, there's Hot Mondays is another event that was happening. These are all videos, and you can go and you can learn the latest dances, you can learn who the dancers are. The names of the dancers are known internationally. This is a New York website in which they're interviewing two dancers from another famous dance who have come to New York. They've been paid to come and dance at a dance hall event in New York because they're so famous and they're so respected as dancers. So the circulation of these videos has become an important tool for building the reputation of dancers. Of course, the circulation of those videos includes the circulation of copyrighted material. So again, you can see that this starts running up against the law in interesting ways. But there's a great, I don't have time to show you the full interview, but there's a great discussion where the dancers talk about showing up in Canada and being recognized on the street by people who have recognized them from the videos. And that's how they know they've made it, is because people have seen them. There's also DVDs that circulate. If you go to any Jamaican music store, there's usually going to be a stack of DVDs from these dances that are all sort of also circulated in a gray market kind of way, because then they also include lots of copyrighted audio on them. So I think we can see here the good side of network technology, which is that there's this ease of circulation outside of traditional gatekeepers. Your fame can reach much more broadly. These dancers seem to be achieving a kind of fame that they seem very happy about and seems to have some financial component as well. It also increases your respect locally to have this stuff circulate. There's a sort of feedback loop as well, where you go abroad, you get famous, you come back, people respect you more. This respect translates into financial advantages, especially in Jamaica where things are very personal. Financial and social advantages are very much overlapped. There's also some other interesting things, like there's increased transparency. You can see what happens to your music or your dance much more easily. You can see where people have downloaded it, where people are watching it. You get YouTube comments. There's more opportunities for feedback in a broader way, which I think is very interesting. And used to be you'd be dependent on someone else for that information. But there's also a bad side, of course, and that is this sort of surveillance aspect of it. There's also the idea that you could, of course, be caught doing something you don't want to be seen doing just generally. There's definitely scandals abounding about that. But I think in relation to copyright, this is, in terms of the law, this is what I'm really interested in, is that it can really report back on these practices which are not really in sync with what the law says. And one concern is that this could lead to, you know, lawsuits or legal threats which could discourage those practices, could dampen them from happening. And I think that's one possibility. I also think, just
an example of these practices?
Sure. So, like, if you're making a, if you have a song that has a sample in it that hasn't been cleared, or if you make a take a American pop tune and you sing your vocals over it, and then you get a threatening letter from an American company, which is something that happens fairly regularly. So, of course, and there's debates about how much harm those letters actually do. I think it's still worth being concerned about these kind of interactions. But I think part of the other thing that can happen is that it just can discourage people from participating in these networks unless they conform to the legal assumptions that are embedded in those networks, which means those networks end up replicating the same thing that we already had, which was an unequal system. So that is the thing that I think I feel I can argue more fiercely for. Although I'm concerned about dampening of local practices on the ground, I think it actually can be quite hard to stop people from doing what they want to do on the day-to-day. But if we want people to be participating in these new networks of communication, these new technologies, then those technologies need to not require people to transform themselves into the right kind of colonial subject in order to play. So that's basically my point. I'm really interested in the way Professor Julie Cohen talks about pervasively distributed copyright, but I don't think that is as important as understanding that the way the street dance and the music works is by creating a kind of space outside of what the law talks about. And there's a scholar named Obika Gray who calls this an exilic space, which just means a space a little bit outside or at the margins of these systems of law and understanding and discussion. And those spaces are where a lot of culture happens and where a lot of culture lives, and I think where a lot of potential for equality is. So I think I'm going to stop there so we have time to talk. So.
Well, thank you. So that was just absolutely fantastic. So.
Oh. Sure.
The floor is open for questions. Shoot.
Since you pretty well demonstrated that, you know, the traditional colonial British copyright law is out of sync. Mm-hmm. With local culture in Jamaica, has there been any move to change the local copyright law of Jamaica to align itself with this culture and away from the British practices?
That's a great catch, because I didn't get a chance to talk about. There was a change in Jamaican copyright law in 1993 when Jamaica joined the World Trade Organization. They were required to sign on to an international agreement, and they rewrote their copyright law. But they rewrote it mostly to be in compliance with the terms as framed by the World Trade Organization and the World Intellectual Property Organization, which makes sense because it would take a lot of research. I mean, people haven't normally been very critical of this at starting out. It would take a lot of resources to invest in what exactly it is they would want to do differently. Where meanwhile, WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, says, we have it all figured out. Here's what you need in order. Here's our universal framework, which is going to make everybody better off, which is a very appealing argument. You now have some pushback, even at WIPO. You have the a coalition of countries from the Global South who have argued for something called the Development Agenda, where they're sort of saying, look, these same rules may not actually work the same for everybody. Interestingly, Jamaica is not part of that group, but Brazil is and Argentina, and I forget the other big one, are big parts of it.
Has there been any move in Jamaica to say, well, this doesn't work for us, let's just withdraw from it?
No, I think, I mean, participating in the World Trade Organization, I mean, they want to be a part of it. I mean, there are the reasons why you could say they shouldn't be if you're against those kind of things, but I think it would be a big cost to them to do that. So I'm trying to find a way to carve out an argument.
Or to withdraw just from the copyright part of it.
Yeah, it's a condition of joining, so.
I'm a huge fan of the Jamaican music as well, and I heard you talk about the dance, which is very important
and the rhythms, but not the sound.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably, I don't know how much in terms of the level of copyright laws that might affect them, but I imagine the sounds, which is the group of DJs that play together, they usually are requested, like the dancers, all over the country by their name, by the group name, but they also make a lot of CDs.
Oh, yeah.
They make CDs, so what have you explored that?
Yeah, so the sounds, like the sound systems are the crews that, run the sound systems, and then there are also the studios, which are sometimes the same and sometimes different, right, that generate the recordings. So yeah, there are many different actors. I think the interesting thing about the sound systems is that historically those have been the people that bought, if they did buy, bought recordings. Mm-hmm. And the mass of the public engaged with music through attending live events. And so the whole concept of producing recordings for sale to the mass public is not really relevant to most of Jamaican musical history. And so that's another way in which it's really different from at least the model that copyright law says, you know, of how sort of money is generated in the music scene. So sounds and studios were often historically affiliated with like liquor stores and bars and places where people generated money in other ways that went into the music industry. And I think being involved in other dance music scenes, I think this is in fact still true in a lot of I mean, the dance is a really interesting part of it, because even in dance music in the US and in Europe, it's not really about selling the recordings. It's about selling admission to the event and then these ancillary sort of costs. But you're right, I mean, they're immensely important. But I think one of the ways they're important is that they are another way that they break off what people think is being produced and where the money is generated. It's sort of going in a different path than it is in the way this American copyright law has sort of told a story about music.
But isn't that exactly where the problem comes, in a sense? There is this local environment, and all right, there's a production system for that. But if you're suppose you're a music producer in Jamaica, and you feel you have an artist and you'd like to go for the big money, are you a copyright advocate or a copyright opponent at that point?
That's a great question. I mean, different producers I talked to were divided on that. I did a lot of interviews, and many of them said, recognized that promotion was really important, and that it's, I mean, there's a lot of payola too, like people are desperate to get their music on the radio, so they're spending money rather than demanding someone pay them money in order to get their music out there. So a lot of them recognize like another way the music circulates is through mix CDs, which it's actually quite difficult to buy music officially in Jamaica. There are not that many record stores. What you do is you go to the gas station and there's a guy there with a stack of mix CDs, and he has whatever's hottest. If you want to know, also, if you want to be current, you have to go to him, because they come out every single week. And the mix CDs are not licensed. And artists and producers both were like, well, it would be nice to get money for that, but at the same time, it's promotion, and I want my stuff to be on there because I want people to hear it. And for artists, it's easier because they can do live performance, so they can get paid for that. For producers, one of the interesting things that happened is they get artists to sing their name, the producer's name, in the song so that you know who the producer is. And then someone else will go to that producer when they want to make a hit. So people find ways to sort of deal with, I think reputation is really, to me, the really important part of how this works. And focusing on the recordings, I just think it isn't going to get you as far. There was a hand here. No,
yeah. Just making sure there's nobody behind me, because that sometimes happens. Related to that question, is there a relationship with increasing success and changing positions? I remember in Wayne's Berkman talk, he had given an example where a YouTube sort of circulation pattern that made a group successful, once they got signed, then they were taking it off. And related to that, what type of actual enforcement attempts are there in Jamaica for individuals, for Jamaica as a country, for the Jamaican diaspora, or other extended community?
All right, so the first question is about, do people's positions change? And they do in different cases, people I talk to. And one is, in a lot of ways, in relation to a lot of formal law, when I ask people, like, did they sign contracts? Did they use written contracts? They would say, I'm not at that level yet. So people were really sophisticated about when it is appropriate to make use of these formal systems and when not. And I think it makes perfect sense not to get involved in an institution that you don't feel like you're going to be well-positioned to negotiate with. So if you don't have your own lawyer, why are you getting all messed up? If you don't know who this person is that you're signing a contract with, it doesn't really matter if you sign a contract with them or not, because they can just disappear. You'll never see them again. You can't enforce anything on them. You know. So I think people, and I think this was true for copyright enforcement as well, people were aware that at a certain point it might be worth it. But that's a very different question than it's this automatic right, which is true for all time, right? So, and one of the most interesting things was how different the debate was between new artists starting out and older artists with an established back catalog. And I think this is where copyright in relation to creativity, I just think that whole relationship needs to be erased, because I just don't buy it in general. I don't think it makes sense. And I think that it's a way of managing product. If you think of recordings as products, and so people who have a lot of back catalog, they want to manage and they want to control. It makes sense for them to think about copyright. But I don't think the reason that they don't own it often is because at the time it wasn't as important to them. They didn't know it was going to be valuable, and so it was more important for them to get it out there or to get paid their one-time shot, you know. And that made perfect sense at the time. So it's difficult because there is a massive amount of unfairness in the system. There are tons of artists who are in their 70s who are still touring. I mean, some of them want to, but some of them would rather be relaxing, you know, but someone else owns all their back catalog. I'm just not very confident that copyright law is going to solve that problem, because I actually think it's a much larger problem around the relationship of people without power to people with power. And I think property rights usually gravitate towards the powerful. So I'm curious about if there's ways around that, because I don't want to say that nobody should have any rights in that situation, but I'm very wary of copyright in that situation. And then the next question was about enforcement.
What right? examples have actually come down and pushback, resistance?
I mean, enforcement also tracks this issue of power, right? It depends how much power you have to invoke the law on your behalf and how meaningful it is. So Vibes Cartel did a song with Spice on a tune, on a rhythm that was actually the instrumental to a Ne-Yo song, which is his American hip-hop artist on EMI, I think it was. And EMI eventually sent Vibes Cartel a cease and desist letter.
But that's from outside. Are there examples of Jamaicans enforcing
it? I couldn't find a single person who ever said. Okay. They talked about suing each other.
I was also interested in within Jamaica or Jamaica versus outside,
I mean, I think, and this goes back to the coloniality of power, engaging with the legal system is not that appealing a process, and I have to say, as someone who was there too, you know, it takes a lot to get involved, and it's not a very predictable or reliable thing, and you can't really, I mean, it's also a very small place, so all the people who are in positions of power are people you're likely to know, and who are likely to know you personally, especially in the music scene, so there's no neutral, abstract system to engage with. So that adds a whole other layer, I think, into people's willingness to engage with it. So if you're friends with the Minister of Culture, you know, that's a whole different thing, you know. But and that's it's a small enough place that can happen, right? But I think that's really what, you know, why giving too many tools for enforcement seems to me to be just likely to increase inequality. So I'm more into carving out spaces of experimentation and play where people can generate stuff. I think this. Saw your hand
first. Okay, I have a lot of questions, but I'll ask one.
Okay.
My understanding of Jamaica, you know, is that it's very class-oriented, and extreme to the extreme. And you know, it sounds like to me, if I had to guess, that I would say the top is going to go along with the rest of the world in terms of the copyright law. There's not going to be any change, and it's all within Jamaica. It's not the rest of the world versus Jamaica colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So can you sort of play that out, talk about that a little bit.
I mean, I wouldn't separate it, right? Because the reason the people are at the top, I mean, the people at the top also are the, you know, mostly the white minority, right? The people at the top, I mean, like, why are they there? Why are they at the top? What are the institutions that put them at the top?
Centuries of wealth construction.
Right, but like colonialism, right? So, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, it happens within Jamaica too, but I mean, there is the reason that the people at the top are more congruent with these global colonial systems is because that's how they got to be at the top in the first place. So yeah, I agree. It happens within. I'm not saying it's like the big bad outside world on Jamaica. Definitely, I'm saying this coloniality of power filters all the way through the system. So does that make sense?
So you're not going to see any change in the law in Jamaica because of that. That was my question.
I mean, I think there are ways to make arguments around creativity and around the value that people generate through making art that you that you can make. But I think it's true that there's a lot of hostility at the top. I mean, I didn't talk about this, but these exilic spaces, you know, they're spaces mostly for the urban poor, and there's a lot of anxiety among the upper class about what happens in those spaces, and they aren't excited to invest in local creativity that much. A lot of the major corporations, for example, that hire local artists are foreign, like to represent them are foreign, like cell phone companies and whatnot. So it's, you know, it's starting to change a little bit, but there is definitely, I think, you know, an unwillingness to invest in the local culture of the urban poor, which is really, I mean, I didn't get to talk about that, but it's really, you know, the central identifying aspect of the most popular music in Jamaica is that it's the urban poor, or the poor especially, you know, and that's explicit in the music. People claim that all the time. So what's interesting, though, is that doesn't have the same resonance outside of Jamaica. So people do get a chance to actually circumvent that, for example, through these networks of digital communication, that is, that they can reach popularity in the U.S. that they wouldn't get, because American elites are not threatened in the same way. So, you know, that could be a pressure, in a way, if that happened. You know, we'll see. It has happened to some extent. I think you had a question? Yeah.
So I wonder if you can go into a little bit more detail about how gender plays into all of this, because obviously that's a different power dynamic within the power dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, it occurred to me, the prime minister is a female.
Not correct? Anymore, I don't think.
Used to be.
Yeah, the previous one was.
I just wonder how that, if that played into, you know, how many women or girls are coming up the ladder around this.
That's a really interesting question.
Producing as well.
Yeah, I didn't get a chance to look at it specifically. Although women are an important force on the dance floor, and also sexuality, not just gender, but sexuality is a really interesting discussion around what's happening on the dance floor and elsewhere. There aren't a lot of women producers. I met two female engineers.
Mm-hmm.
There are definitely female vocalists, but they're not as many as men. And also, they sort out differently in the different genres of music very much. But the other side of that, I think, is that women are much more employable within Jamaica in other jobs. Women are seen to some extent as like the people you want in offices. Mm. Right, so women have actually access to a kind of economic stability that, to some extent, at least poor men don't really get. So there's a really interesting divide there. So it's not just that, like, poor men have access to the fame and glamour and excitement of the music scene and the chance at stardom, whereas women are kept out. It's also that poor men aren't actually necessarily seen as civilized enough to be in office jobs and have steady paychecks. So there's a sort of, it's a really, I mean, this is one of the things about being there, but like the way the sort of colonial understandings of race and gender play out are really different in some ways than you know, what I learned about how things like that play out here. I mean, there's parallels in some cases, but that's one of them. So the relationship of women to power and economic independence is quite different in a few ways. And that feeds into also, like, there's a lot of anxiety about sexuality and about inappropriately sexual activity on the dance floor. And I think that also has to be set against this idea that women have actually some kinds of economic power that they don't have in other places. And also including, one of the things that was really striking, I remember being on the dance floor a lot and at like 2 or 3 in the morning, and the DJ would get on the mic and say, "This song goes out to all the baby mamas in the house. Put your one hand up if you got one baby, and two hand up if you got two babies." Everybody was into it, and nobody was saying, you know, "Oh, I can't believe she's out, you know, at this late hour, you know, who's watching the kids?" You know, because people were watching the kids, because people do take, like, there's aunties, there's cousins, there's people in the neighborhood, and that was a way in which I felt that they were more free than I felt like I would be if I was trying to go out dancing in America, because there was, it's not to, you know, make it idyllic, there's plenty of problems, but gender and power issues are so different there that like the way people have access to different spaces is quite different.
And also, if little girls are looking at, yeah, okay, I can fit into the system on some level in some way, I wonder if that affects their creativity as well.
Yeah.
Because if you're marginalized and have to go into other spaces, that actually affects your creativity.
Oh yeah.
Well, so.
Oh yeah. I mean, but I mean, so you're marginalized from one, but you have economic independence in another,
yeah.
Which you could express your creativity without having to depend on it to make a living, because then there's a whole issue of commodification. Right? I mean, like, so, I mean, I just, that it's complicated. I think you're right, like, and gender is a super interesting, complex lens, and I just got enough to be like, oh, wow, I have to set this aside after the dissertation, yes. But I'm planning to come back to it.
Cool.
Is there?
Yeah. Does the rhythm tend to get just made once, and then you're endlessly reused and sampled, and if that's what happens, how do the people who make the rhythm, you know, get any, you know, compensation or profit from what they've done? The singers presumably tour, and the people mm-hmm. who make the rhythm, what do?
Well, there's two things. So first, yeah, like a rhythm will be made once. Often then it will get reworked a few times. If it's popular, people might do it again and again. So Stalag actually has a few versions that are slightly different, been updated in different ways, and that's often true of really popular rhythms. But you're right, people don't tend to get paid royalties for circulation that much, as far as I know. But if you're a producer, you have a studio. And if your rhythm is popular, that means that you're a hot producer. And that means that people are going to come to you and say, I want a tune, you know, I want you to make me a rhythm as good as that other rhythm. So, I mean, I think people use the resources that they can control, right? And they can't control the circulation. And I think the whole system has been set up so that circulation provides its own value. And instead, if you can control your studio, access to your studio, that's where you charge your money there. You charge them. So I think that's pretty much what I saw.
Actually, you remind me that Winston Reilly, who produced Stalag, sued Bounty Killer for a use of Stalag that was unauthorized.
Right.
Which we mentioned in the Rhythm Method article.
That's right.
But, so that's one example. And of course, but in that case, you know, you've got a guy who recorded this with a band in 1973, he probably paid the band members
yeah.
a daily wage for it, and has been exercising as much control over it as he can in the right instances, you know, in the years since.
It's a 40-year-old rhythm, almost.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, right, and that brings up this other issue, right, which is, again, this issue of identifiable owners and how, you know, naming the author and an owner of a song is just a political act. Like, they have, you know, these are collaborative works. And so the fact that Winston Reilly owns the copyright to a recording which has, you know, six musicians playing on it, and who knows who wrote what. You know, it's the same with like Clyde Stubblefield playing drums for James Brown, right? He doesn't own the song. James Brown owns the song, but the drum beat is what gets sampled over and over again in The Funky Drummer, right? So copyright doesn't solve that problem at all, because it's already assigning ownership after the fact. So.
Bob Marley doesn't own Bob Marley.
Nope.
John, did you want
to? So you mentioned the ways in which copyright isn't necessarily working, and if there could be alternative regimes. And so, of course, since I study free culture, my mind goes to, well, for, you know, software, there's the GPL. For prose, there's Creative Commons. And if not in Jamaica, but elsewhere in the music scene, are there people trying to conceptualize in a more legal, formalistic way what it would be like to have licenses that would apply to rhythms and voiceovers, and trying to create a repository where that would be of use? And if not, I'm just curious why.
I think that, I mean, I haven't seen many people trying to conceptualize a formal alternative to the current copyright regime. I mean, in a way, that's what the kind of conversation I'm trying to spark, really, you know. But, and I think part of that is because the way that the law is presented is that this is the rational way to do things, as opposed to this sort of unstructured and crazy thing that you guys have all been doing before now. There's not this idea that there's like competing understandings of how this should all work. It's presented as like the way, which I think is, you know, not uncommon in these situations. And it's also presented as the professional way. So if you're serious and you want to be a professional and you want to make it, you have to try to transform yourself into a professional, serious, making it kind of person who thinks about your music in a particular way. And I've definitely seen people speak very much in a sort of self-help way about like remaking themselves into a kind of professional musician. What's interesting is when that actually affects their changes in behavior, because a lot of them say that but aren't doing any of that. And so while they don't have any, they don't make any formal alternative, they're continuing to use the networks that they already are using, and in some cases expanding them, like with the dancers and the videos and stuff like that. Like, if there's an organic thing happening. The question is if there is a value in formalizing that or not. And that's kind of what I'm curious about is that, you know, there may be, I would like at least to be able to carve out a sort of protective space for allowing these kind of things to happen. I'm not sure, you know, beyond limiting the derivative works, right, maybe, and, you know, some other things like that, what, you know, what formal things are going to really help. Because getting people to see themselves as people who the law reflects positively on is a much larger project than just dealing with copyright. I mean, most people, I think, don't think about the law very often in their daily life if they don't have to. And so if you, unless you're a lawyer, of course. But I mean, you know, so when I talk to entertainment lawyers and they're like, oh, it's really easy to make legal art. You just go through these six steps when you're making a song. And I'm like, yeah, you know. No, you know, do you ever hang out with artists? Like, people don't create that way. So that's the problem with the formal structure. I think it needs to make sense of itself for what people are doing, which is kind of what I'm hoping to inform. Is that in the back there?
Hi, thanks. You spoke a little bit about how there's the possibility for a chilling effect coming from, you know, the digital technology as well as the copyright law. But I'm curious, you know, knowing what you know now from your field work there, and projecting that forward, mm-hmm. how do you see, if at all, Jamaica possibly changing its cultural production and experience of that culture, mm-hmm. given global trends in culture, economics, intellectual property law, and those having a greater effect with these global networks, you know, yeah. becoming more integrated?
Yeah, great question. Well, it's hard to talk about what a chilling effect would actually look like, because I don't want to be super deterministic about how the law like creates people's behavior in it, because I don't think it's very convincing on the ground. But I do think you can make a policy argument about why make a law that is so antithetical to what people are doing. Like, if the argument is that, well, it doesn't affect them anyway, that doesn't seem to me to be a very good argument for why you should have that policy. I mean, if you want policy to exist, it seems like it should make sense. And if it doesn't make sense to say, well, it's not going to, no one's going to follow it, like, why have it? So there's that side of it. And then there's, again, like, the concern that I do have, I think, which is people's ability to participate in these networks, I think, can be chilled. And that, I think, is a real concern for me. That is, it's not that people will stop being interactive, but if they can't, if everybody else is on YouTube or whatever the new thing is, and you can't get on unless you transform yourself to be the right kind of person, that limits your ability to take advantage of those kind of networks. And so that is kind of one of the things I'm concerned about, is whether, I mean, and I think we've seen this already, you know, with the changes that are happening in SoundCloud and all of these other platforms where they start out allowing a lot of kinds of flexibility and communities to develop, and then once they get big enough to be noticed and make money, they just clamp down and kick out everybody who was doing all that stuff. And so, you know, the sort of corporatization and privatization that's happening all over, I think, again, certain people always come out on the bottom, and that's, you know, it can happen again and again, but I'd rather it didn't. So I think that's kind of how I wonder about where it's going. What's interesting, of course, is at the same time you have this massive anxiety globally around copyright, because digital music is starting to approach the situation which Jamaica already had in the beginning. So I kind of feel like maybe we should be looking instead for inspiration at what happened in Jamaica. Because although the allocation of profits was totally unequal, the amount of productivity is unbelievable. I mean, what the kind of music, and you know, I think in 95 the UN estimated that 3% of all global music production was reggae. And when you consider there's like 2.5 million people on the island and not all of them were making reggae, that's kind of mind-boggling. And that's just reggae, not even the other kinds of music, right? So, I mean, I just think the potential is there to learn a lot more from these kind of experiences. And Jamaica isn't the only one, but it's one of the really interesting ones. So I kind of hope we go the other way. I see, who hasn't spoken? You haven't spoken.
I mess around with French language music. I have a radio show, webcast, and organize concerts with French language artists. I had an interesting experience with YouTube last year. 2 years ago, a Franco Togolese singer-songwriter came from Paris and gave some concerts, including a Lexington middle school, you know, 12, 13, 14-year-olds. I filmed a concert. I put one song up on YouTube where a little 13-year-old girl had learned one of his songs ahead of time and had the guts to get up on stage and sing with him. They hadn't even rehearsed together, and it was excellent. So I put it up on YouTube. Several months later, I got an email from my friend in Paris, Brice Capel, He says Sony has asked to take this down from YouTube because he had used the music from, I think, a Peter Gabriel song. He's a friend of his.
Right.
For this song, and Sony wanted it taken down off YouTube.
Right. That's right. That's exactly the question is, like, how, you know, and again, I think it shows the sort of antisocial issue, right? Which is, I mean, like, you know, it's sort of like this. I think the funniest example of that for me is the metal fans who upload their, like, beloved reenactments of insane guitar solos, and the better they get, the more likely it is to get taken down, right? Because the closer it approximates the original, when it's, like, the ultimate tribute, right? It's or drum solo, right? If you can get your, like, 187-piece drum set to completely replicate, you know,
Rush.
Like, yeah, a Rush, yeah. You know, 5 minutes of a Rush solo, you know, then it gets taken down, and, you know, maybe that's okay in that moment. That's your accolade, in fact, it could be, but another level, it's kind of a pity because it's exactly the kind of, I think, you know, positive contribution and sort of shared social knowledge that I think leads to a healthier creative community or set of creative communities. So, yeah, I think it's a great example of that.
Is anybody? Yeah, one.
Okay.
I wanted to go back to what you were saying about the question of if a policy is meaningless or divorced from reality, then why have it? Well, it seems as though a possible answer to that might be to join the WTO.
They have joined.
Well, right, but I mean, it could not be argued that they constructed this copyright law not so much because it was designed to actually do what it's supposed to do, but to get them in to an or, you know, to this organization.
Token effort, you mean?
Yeah, right. Like basically, like putting it on a piece of paper and saying, "Oh, yeah, this is our policy," you know, and then using that as a way to secure entry without actually making an effort to enforce it.
Yeah, the problem is the WTO requires that you demonstrate compliance, and they can hit you with trade sanctions if they decide that you're. And they don't. And they can be unrelated trade sanctions, so they could like, you know, cut off your medicines, you know. So, I mean, I don't think they would. That's a dramatic one, right? But. But that's the problem. I mean, like, it still isn't. It's not like it's enforced everywhere. I mean, like, there's a lot of things that need to be enforced if you want to enforce it.
What I was wondering is, since you have this WTO-mandated policy that replaced what was a colonially imposed policy, did you find that attitudes within Jamaica towards copyright differed significantly from, say, attitudes that you find more commonly in the United States?
I don't... It would be hard to generalize about the United States attitudes towards copyright because it's pretty big. But I think the interesting thing, and this I didn't get into here because it's a different set of stories, is a lot of people in Jamaica are very positive about copyright law because I think for two reasons. And one is that it's presented as the way to get what's yours and something that's been historically denied you. I think that a lot of that doesn't take into account the way enforcing it would actually require, like, people think of it as the thing that manages the stuff you already made. They don't think of how it affects your creative process while you're making stuff, right? So that is one, I think, problem with it. But I think that there is something important about people want to claim rights. They want to be rights-bearing people. They want to be taken seriously. These are people who have not had a historical experience of being treated well or taken seriously by global systems, quite the reverse. So there's a real importance in being someone who has rights, who has ownership, especially people who used to be property, right? The idea of owning stuff is going to be important and needs to be, like, taken seriously as a thing. The question is, what does ownership mean in that context? Does it have to mean the same thing? Because a lot of people want to claim rights, but then when it comes down to it, they don't necessarily care about the same things that other folks care about with respect to those rights. And
they might have different understandings of what is ownable.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah, the definition of ownership may be quite different. So... I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's kind of what, I mean, local attitudes, I mean, like, people on the whole think of it as the thing that manages the stuff you already made so that you get what's yours. But that's not, I don't have as much of a problem with that as I do with the whole beginning process of how you generate stuff and how people, everyone else engages with stuff. So.
Matt, there was a comment I wanted to make before and then I let it go. And now it seems that the question that was just posed reflects and reproduces what I feel is a fundamental misstatement of the situation in your presentation, which is, you know, we have this colonial era, we have this colonial past, we have this colonial heritage. Now we have today, brave new world. But we have a neo-colonial system.
That's the opposite. I must have misrepresented because I'm actually.
WTO is a neocolonial absolutely. Organization. It's not. No, this is the bad past. Now we have the WTO. We have some hope. No, it's
absolutely.
I mean, global capitalism is still functioning pretty much as it was.
Absolutely.
And I think, I assume that in Jamaica, you have a reproduction of class structure that you have worldwide. And you have the elite, which would prefer to ally itself with the neocolonial system, a part of it.
Absolutely.
And then you have the masses, which include most of these creative people, I assume, who would not.
Absolutely. I'm sorry if I gave a different impression, but that's exactly what I was saying all the way through.
Implied what I'm saying. But the way you formulated about being, oh, this was the colonial era, this was the colonial regime, and now we have today. And I felt that this speaker, this questioner, had taken that in uncritically, and I just wanted to opinion about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That's the impression I meant to leave.
Before we close, could I ask our one Jamaican national here, is there any kind of reaction to what you...
Certainly, and as mentioned in the presentation, it's very much a bottom, from the bottom up in terms of how music is generated. And another comment that someone posed as to why don't producers take more ownership of their work, the shelf life, a lot of these rhythms are just each, every 2 weeks or thereabouts, you have a famous artist who is making something new, something fresh. So it's something that's very, very malleable and it changes so frequently that you could be irrelevant by the time your paperwork is approved.
That's a great point. Like alongside these rhythms that last 40 years, because people don't control the circulation, there's just this sort of blunderbuss approach of producing as much as possible all the time, which is fantastically creative, but means, yeah, there's lots of turnover. Thank you for reminding me.
Larissa, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.